Welcome back to Take Five. So on our expat holiday edition, a first old friend that we wanted to have on is Eric Oosterwijk, and I'm probably butchering your name. Eric is the owner of Fells Point Meats, and Dutch by birth and a butcher by trade, and maybe you've always been one of the most interesting people for Cindy and I to work with on things, and your business has grown as our business has grown, and wanted to have you on because I think you have a really interesting story.
Well, thank you.
So why don't you give us the 2-minute version of your life story and how it is you got from Holland to the U.S. and why you're a butcher and all those fascinating details.
Well, I'm a butcher because my father was a butcher. So that's, 3 out of 6 boys actually did the same thing at my house, and the other 3 were smart and went to school. But I grew up in Holland, was born in 61, and in 81 I ended up in the United States working for someone in D.C. And by 1988... we started a retail shop. I started a retail shop in the Broadway market right here in Fells Point. And that turned into a wholesale company supplying restaurants around town, starting out in Fells Point. And today we have moved 3 times, my partner Leo and I, who Leo is also Dutch, and we have about 85 employees and supply almost 600 restaurants and hotels and country clubs and caterers and such in the Baltimore, Washington, Northern Virginia area.
Did you think you'd be doing that when your dad was first teaching you? Did your dad teach you, or did you apprentice somewhere? Or how did that work when you were a kid?
Well, vocational schools in Holland are still there, but back then it was even more so. You could go to a specialty school, which I did, which was a 6-year program, 1 day a week. I only did 4 years because I ended up in the United States and I was going to finish it coming back, but I never did. And of course, my father did teach me a lot. As a kid, a 12-year-old, I started working in the shop on Saturdays and cleaning and doing little things like that, making sausage. And then I really got an interest to do this for a living, as I thought, and went to school and started working full-time besides the 1 day of school. And by the time I went to the U.S., I probably worked at 2 or 3 different places, small butcher shops, where I learned a lot of things and continue to learn as I ended up in the United States.
And when you started working in the U.S. in a butcher shop, what was the first gigantic difference from being in Holland?
What was very different was I was taught in the retail trade, always worked in the retail trade, and I went to work for a distributor, which was owned by a Dutch guy also, in Washington, D.C., and he supplied restaurants and hotels about the same as what we do today. That company was sold out in the 90s to Cisco, but I worked for him for... about 6 years, almost 6 years. And that's when I left and had a couple of months worth of working here and there. And then I opened up my little shop in the Broadway market. The big difference was the wholesale versus the retail.
So the meat cuts were the same, not the same?
Somewhat the same, but there were a lot of new things. I was seeing things that I had not seen in Holland. For instance, the amount of veal that we processed here was not being done in Holland. I think the Dutch stopped eating veal a long, long time ago. And it's the same trend of what we see here today. It's something that's being sold less and less for particular reasons. And some of the lamb cuts were different and some of the beef cuts were different.
I know when I go to France, especially the first time to France, looking in a butcher shop, all the beef cuts are gigantically different than what you see than what you see in the U.S. And now it seems like they're a little bit closer.
Very much so, yes. And that's absolutely true, too. I mean, now you can actually go to Holland, you can get a ribeye, and you can get T-bones, and you can get, back in the days, you couldn't. And maybe you could, but I had never seen it, never confronted it in as many places as I had worked. So the big difference was also the sizes of the portions. When we would cut steaks in Holland, they were 100 grams, 125, 150 grams, or for a real hungry guy, maybe 200 grams. Here we were cutting 12, 14, 16-ounce New Yorks, being 450 grams. So huge differences in portion sizes also.
Well, things price out pretty differently too, right?
Well, yes.
So I mean, sourcing for just beef, for example, sourcing for beef is so different in the U.S. than it is in Europe.
It is. And I think the U.S. has caught up on a lot of things.
See, a lot of people, I think, have a prejudice thinking, well, American beef is the best beef in the world, so they must be ahead on everything having to do with it.
Maybe. and you know, I might have some of the same thoughts about it.
Do you think it was that way when you first got here?
It was very different. We used to never eat that much meat, but when we had an entrecote or a New York strip, as you call it here, it was a lot leaner. It's mostly grass fed. Or we had a lot of Irish beef, knowing that Irish beef in our part of the world was probably some of the finest beef out there. But it wasn't corn fed like here. I think once you get used to it, and you get used to the corn fed taste, a good piece of prime meat, it's very hard to go back to, let's say, a piece of Australian beef, which is grass fed, or maybe even a piece of Dutch beef. Now, I go back every year and I always eat some of it, including some other meats such as horse meat, which is
go bananas about that here. And yeah. I can think of two places I specifically go to looking for horse meat. One is up in the Dolomites, mm-hmm. in the north of Italy, and there and in the Alps. You get lots and lots of brazaola and that kind of dried meat, but especially horse meat.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
in Sardinia, you know, always little minute steaks, mm-hmm. you know, just like cut from rumps and
yeah.
rare and fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely.
But,
absolutely.
Yeah, that's not a popular topic.
No, it's not. It's not. So we're not going to talk about that. We're talking about the beef is great here. And so, yeah, that was another difference with a lot more fat in the animal than I was used to.
It's funny, in Europe, you think about all the different regions. Everyone seems to have their different pride. Like in Iberian Peninsula, you know, it's always about Galician beef, Gallego beef. Every Spanish winemaker friend of mine is always bragging about that as good or better than any Argentine or any American beef or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
You go to Italy and you know, Fiorentina, the muscular beef from Tuscany, the famous cut. Those people, they swear and swear and swear by that. But then you go to the most famous butcher shop in Tuscany, and that guy's buying Galician beef.
Correct.
It's
yeah.
one of the great sort of secrets in the butcher shop in Panzano.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you go to Piemonte, and you're in the same nation, and they immediately brag about there's a certain chauvinism, it seems like, to meat.
Right. And in Holland, that is true also to a certain extent. For instance, when you want lamb, and lamb is not a big item such like it is in the U.S. or some of the Mediterranean countries, for instance, the lamb from Texel, which is one of the islands off the North Holland coast to the north, everybody talks about, especially the people from Texel, say that's the best lamb in the world. It might be to them, but it's not necessarily to other people. So most of the beef, you don't have the different types of beef in Holland as you have here or maybe in Italy or France. Most of it is Holstein, which is being fed a different way. And they also eat a lot of cow meat versus steer meat in the United States. That's a big difference, too. So we don't know these differences between various breeds of cattle as much as they do in other parts of the country.
Have you seen giant impact? I know the origin of food people in the last 5 years especially have gone crazy about. You know, it down to, you know, this chicken named George laid these eggs that I made your omelet with kind of thing.
Right.
But we produce, you know, so many, I mean, what, billions of pounds of beef in this country, right, in the course of a year.
Absolutely.
So, but do you think that people, do you see trends in your business? Are people actually willing to pay for a very particular origin?
They
organically
do.
Fed beef, grass-fed beef, you know, that?
Absolutely, they do. And it's the organic and the grass-fed, not so much. You know, out of the 600 customers, I don't think we have one that's looking for organic or grass-fed or using it. All natural is a big thing. Being all natural could mean a lot of things, but the program that we have put out by Creekstone Farms out of Kansas is an all-natural with a never-ever program, meaning it never had antibiotics or hormones during the course of the life.
That seems like the big terror for a lot of consumers. That
it is.
They're somehow consuming some chemical unwittingly from the meat that they're consuming.
Absolutely, and I think that trend is getting better, and I'm glad it's there because none of us really want to eat this, and I don't feed it to my family either. So the other big trend, which I'm really happy to see, is the local trend. We do a lot of business with lots of local farms where we get anything from lamb to beef, a lot of different pork, even different birds. I think that's
now something. versus 10 years ago, it's super crazy different.
Tremendous,
right?
Yeah. Tremendous. And I don't think it's going to go away. I think it's going to continue to grow.
Well, it should be common sense. I mean, it's the same thing. My great-grandmother used to take me to market. She was born in 1890, this little old German lady. And she would take me to Lexington Market when I was like 6, 7 years old and, you know, teach me to smell things and look at the roots of things and the seeds of things and see how fresh something was. And it was there still dirt on it and that kind of thing. And, you know, then when I first started working in the restaurant business, we're buying product that's all coming packaged individually and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, I've been fighting for years to go and get the stuff with the dirt on it from the farmers.
Right.
You know, so that's actually happening on the protein side of things.
It's a long education for people because as we're used to eating blueberries 52 weeks out of the year and strawberries and this and that, they're coming from different parts of the world. But a lot of people are going back to, you know what, I can't get them locally. I'm going to eat something different. That's not necessarily true with protein. I mean, you can pretty much raise chickens 52 weeks out of the year. But some of the vegetable stuff is where the chefs also today are learning to cook with winter vegetables more. And whatever they can get locally, that's what they're serving.
Yeah. Seasonal cooking is something we always fight to do. And if it's May, you eat asparagus. The rest of the year, you don't.
Right.
It's going to be fantastic. I know exactly where it's coming from. And we have interesting things to do with it. We've spent this entire segment on education on meat.
That's right.
We're going to come back in a little bit, and I want to hit you up about holiday traditions here versus Holland when you're growing up.
Great.
And recipes. So if it's Christmas dinner, what is the number one thing that someone should be putting on their table?
Well, in Holland, a number of things. Working in a butcher shop, we used to make a lot of fondue platters. And when you're talking fondue, most people are
thinking... Fondue for Christmas.
Fondue for Christmas. Most people think cheese or chocolate. That's not the case. This is meat. So these platters are being made with a variety of things. They could be little meatballs wrapped in a piece of pancetta, Dutch pancetta, it's like a speck. Little slices of tenderloin, seasoned, marinated, little pieces of chicken marinated, and you sit around the table for hours and hours drinking wine.
You're dipping meat in cheese, or you're dipping meat in meat?
No, in oil, or mostly in hot oil, which is heated by a sterno in the center of the table, or you have a few of those pots on the table, so everybody can reach them within safety. Or it's sometimes done in a bouillon, like in a beef stock.
I want to ask you more about this when we come back. So this is not exactly your Christmas turkey or ham.
No, but turkey is being done more often, but never used to. Back in the days, it was maybe a drumstick. But today, it's a little bit more whole birch.
When we come back to Take Five, I'm going to spend a little more time interviewing Eric Oosterwijk, a Dutch butcher, on fondue for Christmas.
That's right.
So now we're back on Take Five with Eric Oosterwijk. So you're telling me fondue, a variety of kinds of fondue for the holidays, that's what you grew up with.
That was
a normal thing for... Now, was Christmas the big deal? Were there other holidays? What was celebrated in your house? What was celebrated in your culture growing up?
Well, the big deal, of course, is Christmas. Santa Claus, St. Nicholas, or Sinterklaas in Dutch, is December 5th. That's the big day for presents. You make a nice meal, but it's more like snacks and stuff like that that you eat that night when Santa Claus comes and bangs on the door and gives you the presents. Christmas is more for the adults, and the dinner is really being focused on. And when I say fondue, that wasn't the only thing. A lot of people would have loved to do some braised rabbit or hare, which is hard to get in this country, but we always used to get hare, and we ate it. Or there was maybe even some deer meat, which is really not easy to get in Holland.
I wouldn't think in the low country that's so easy.
No, it wasn't. And mostly it was German. So then again, Germany gets it from New Zealand a lot now. So it's that's farm raised. Or it was maybe exclusively a pheasant or some other birds.
So a lot of game.
Absolutely.
Game is a lot of the tradition.
Something very special. But being the butcher, tenderloin and New York strip and those kind of things were also... But I remember making more fondue and gourmet platters. Now, gourmet is something that we really don't know. It's every person around the table has a little individual fry pan, and everything is sliced versus cubed And now you're cooking your own little thing above your own little sterno as you're sitting around with different sauces, salads, you know, and it's just a 3 or 4 or 5 hour gig.
Seems like a hot eating and drinking picnic.
It is. And and a lot of people really enjoy that, and it's really big. So
and is there particular spirits, wines, what else do you usually see that time of the year in
definitely,
Holland?
Definitely wine, champagne, of course, with New Year's. That's what they usually start off. Champagne maybe for Christmas. White and red wines, beers, after dinner drinks. I think that is no different there than it's here in particular. Of course, a good shot of Jenever, which is the, so to speak, the Dutch vodka, is always good with, you know, in that time of year.
Other things we don't pronounce correctly and probably never will. The most famous cheese of Holland.
Gouda.
Gouda.
Right. And it's Gouda here, and it's a cheese that comes in many shapes and sizes and aged and more aged and young. It's still one of my favorites. To me, that's a normal lunch to have some good wheat bread and a piece of Gouda on it. Gouda. really much still enjoying it every day.
Have you become more comfortable with mispronouncing the name of the cheese than pronouncing it correctly?
Absolutely. It's a lot easier for me to say Gouda anymore.
Well.
Yeah.
And so what do you want under your Christmas tree this year? What is the number one thing?
Under my Christmas tree, there's not a whole lot more, that I need. But generally, it's the normal stuff. The girls, my daughters, they get their gifts and it's clothing. And I'll probably have the same thing. It'll be a new belt. It'll be a bird feeder for the backyard or something like that. Don't need a whole lot more than that anymore.
Well, thanks very much for coming in on Take 5. Have a great holiday.
You do the same. Thank
Appreciate
you so
being
much.
Here.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. And so now I'm going to turn to one of my favorite emigres to the U.S., Joseph Poupon, who runs Patisserie Poupon here in Baltimore. And Joseph, good to have you here this afternoon.
Yes. Thank you, Tony, for having me.
Of course.
Yeah.
And Joseph's is a really interesting story coming to the U.S. and another story of food across borders, I guess. And so you grew up where?
I grew up in western France, in an area called Brittany, I'll say about 20 miles from the coast, small town, not too far away from Quimper.
So tell me about growing up, how you decided to do what it is that you do, and tell us what you do.
Originally, I intended on going to cooking school, but I couldn't get in, so I took a job as an apprentice in a local pastry shop close by where my parents live, about 20 minutes away.
And how old were you when you started
that? I started at 15, so I did that until about I was 18. It was a 3-year apprenticeship in order to get, my certification.
And then where did you... Then what got you from that point to coming to the U.S.?
From that point, after that, I had another job still in Brittany there too. And I had opportunity to come to U.S., I started in New York at a pastry shop called Maurice Bonté. He was a mayor of Rue de France, so he was a very skilled worker in France, and he had just opened a shop in New York. So I thought I had a good opportunity to come to the U.S. and also to perfect my skills at the same time. So it was a really good chance I had, yeah.
So you were, 19 when you came?
I wasn't even 19. I was close. I mean, I came in, I was 18 and a few months, yeah. Yeah.
So you worked in New York for him for a while?
Yeah.
And what got you to this part of the U.S.?
After that, I had a job in Washington. I worked in a French restaurant near the White House there for a few years, and then I knew Mr. Terzikel from Baltimore, and had a restaurant here.
The old Chef Fernand.
Yeah, the old Chef Fernand. Yeah, Then basically, I mean, he bought some buildings in the city and helped me open the store there, where I am right now at 820 East Baltimore Street. Yeah.
And you've been there for?
It's been 27 years now.
For more than a minute, yeah.
Yeah.
Very good. So, I'm always curious with when someone's chosen to be somewhere they did not grow up. What was the holiday? What was the end of the year? December celebrations, New Year's Eve. If you grew up with Christmas, what was that like for you as a kid? And what is it like now? What did you gain? What did you lose?
Yeah, I have to say that in Brittany, where I come from, we tend to celebrate a lot more on New Year time. I mean, in my family, we did, but at Christmas, it was maybe a little bit smaller, but we had a real nice dinner. And of course, being in Brittany, it's a very Catholic area, so church was very important, and anything, you know, having to do with Christmas.
Was there a special food for Christmas dinner?
We did a lot of. Well, we would get together with families, and it wasn't always at our house. You know, we'd go to different relatives, and I remember clearly having oyster was very big always.
Of course.
And after that, generally we had veal was also very important for us that day, and pastries. Generally, we had the Yule log, and you know. Chocolates and I mean, it was a big meal, definitely.
Yeah, wine, champagne,
always. Champagne always. Yeah. And wine. I mean, wine. We always had wine with dinner. So
the Champenois are the most amazing cultural marketers of all time, aren't they? Yeah. Somehow, you talk to everyone from every region of the world, and all their special times they mark with champagne. I don't know if it's because. It's all the German families and French families competing with each other in that area of France, in business that they are so strong. That because you're talking about marketing, you know, changes in the culture from 100+ years ago. These guys are focused on getting their product to sell all over the world.
Yeah.
When everyone else is barely sort of surviving.
Exactly.
It's an amazing thing. Yeah. Amazing thing.
Yeah. For us, it's hard to conceive. Christmas or any other holiday without having champagne. I mean,
they managed to make it more important than all the other sparkling wine in the world, too. Whether you argue that or not intellectually, it's a really interesting cultural phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what? Let's turn to what happens in the pastry shop here in the holidays. Do what's popular? Does that change? What are the things that people are excited about now?
Currently. We're doing a lot of very very small pastries for like bite-sized pastries, mini version of French pastries for mostly used for people getting together for office parties, and then as we progress, we get closer to Christmas. We do our traditional Bûche de Noël, which are very popular.
How many Bûches de Noël do you think you do on a typical holiday?
I think we do around 1,000. It changes from one year to another.
100,000?
No, 1,000.
1,000.
I'm like, 1,000.
That's not that big of a shop. 1,000 is still a lot of Bûches de Noël.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, they're different. They come in different sizes and things. But
I think it almost seems like the same work regardless of the size, isn't it?
Yes, it is. That's true. Yeah,
that's a funny thing about that sort of thing.
Yeah.
The when you were a kid, when you were thinking about or when you're first learning pastry, when you walked into pâtisserie, what was your favorite thing? What was the thing you were excited about when you were a kid?
Yeah, I mean, I clearly remember
to eat.
I clearly remember being very young, and I went to a soccer game in Paris, and that was my. That was really my first time in Paris, you know. So I remember the what we call the pain au raisin, which are the roll with the Danish dough or the croissant dough with the raisin in it. And those were clearly my I mean, I hadn't seen them at that time yet in Brittany, so they made a big impression on me. I remember eating quite a few of those. Yeah.
Yeah, those yeah. those are all those laminated doughs. I yeah. love those things.
Yeah.
The in Brittany growing up, is there like a country pastry that was a most famous thing?
I mean, we are used to have what we call the gâteau breton, which is like a thick short bread, you know, a big buttery cake, and typically when you get invited to people's house, you get served that at generally yeah. around 4 o'clock. You get
a thick slice of coffee. That yeah. is rich enough. You need coffee and cavados to
yes
to
and you had that at 4 o'clock, but you also had it for at dinner for dessert. You know, those are clearly things I remember really well from childhood having. Maybe not at Christmas. At Christmas, it was something, a pastry that was maybe more creamier, and, more along the line of the bûche. We did a lot of buttercream was really big in those days, too. Yeah, still is, that, but maybe not as much.
And it's the region for it, too.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
The is there, I'm always curious with pastry chefs, dessert wine. Do you like dessert wine with your pastries?
Yes, sir.
If so, mm-hmm. which ones with which?
Yeah, but I don't necessarily go for something too too sweet. I go with, well, it depends a little bit what flavor, but with chocolate, I definitely like a red wine. I think...
like a Banyuls or...
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to have even, you know, I love to have a nice Côte du Rhône, actually, with it, you know.
Ripe sweet yeah. Grenache.
Yes. Yeah.
yeah. Yeah. There is that impression of almost like sweet cherries.
Yeah.
You know, or kirsch, you know, mm-hmm. To a good ripe Grenache.
Yeah. I think that match it goes so well with chocolate.
That's funny. My father, who grew up in Baltimore, who probably didn't have anything but Miller beer for a long, long time, he's always telling me now, you know, that's red wine and chocolate made to go together.
Yeah.
So you guys drew the same conclusion yeah. with slightly different yeah. backgrounds.
Now if I was having, you know, dessert, maybe with a lemon or something, I'll go with something like a white probably. Or champagne, you know.
Yeah, champagne yeah. With some of those light pastries.
Yeah.
Or like Paris-Brest.
Yeah. That's...
It's terrific.
Absolutely.
So what's the number one thing that someone should know about... the pastries that you all do that they may not realize when they walk into the shop?
That's a tough question. As they should know, then, you know, we care a lot about making them, about finding the best ingredient we can possibly find, and we just want to make sure that they really enjoy them and giving them something that is... It's authentic, and you know you should be proud to have at home.
That's the thing about yeah. anything having to do with food. I mean, whether it's your mission, my mission, it's
yeah.
It does come from the heart. It is a real thing. It's a real person doing a real thing that wants you to be pleased.
Mm-hmm. That's, absolutely.
It is the most satisfying thing when people understand that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for coming on Take Five, Joseph.
It was a pleasure, Tony. Yeah.
Have a joyeux Noël.
Oui, merci. Toi aussi.
Welcome back to Take Five. I'm Tony Foreman, and this is our holiday program for Take Five with the butcher, the baker, and now the winemaker. We have an expatriate American living in Piemonte in Italy, Amanda Courtney, on the line. How are you, Amanda?
Great. Thank you. Yourself?
Really good. I've done zero Christmas shopping, but other than that, I'm perfect.
I haven't done too much Christmas shopping myself here either, so...
So, Amanda, like my other guests today, I want to ask you the question, how did you get across borders? What's the food and wine part of your story that got you to where you are?
Well, to really where have gotten me where I am is more the wine part than so much the food part. I mean, growing up as third generation American from my great-grandparents coming from Italy, Italian food Italian wine was always a really big part of my life. A lot of my studies when I was studying to become a sommelier and always working within the wine industry in the United States was always primarily Italian. What brought me really to Piedmont was more my appreciation for the winemaking skills and also the native grape varietals to this region.
For just for fun for listeners, give us a 1 minute education on where is Piedmont and what do they make?
In terms of wine or in terms of food?
In terms of food, we'll be here for 6 hours. In terms of wine,
okay.
the cheat sheet on wine for Piemonte.
Here we go, cheat sheet on wine. We are located on the northwest border, bordering France, and to the north of us is Switzerland. So we're on the most northern western tip of Italy. Here we have a really large range of many different things in terms of food, because we also have part of the Alps. As part of as a major part of our culture here. Also, we have a pretty dominant French background. But in terms of wine, mostly what we have going on here is Nebbiolo. We have a lot of Barbera, Dolcetto. And with Nebbiolo, we have Barolo and Barbaresco as our two major crews area.
Let me slow you down. Sorry.
Okay.
But that's, so the three most important red grapes are Nebbiolo, Barbera,
Nebbiolo, Barbera, Dolcetto.
And the most important mm-hmm. Nebbiolos most famously come from Barolo and Barbaresco, right?
Yes.
But Piemonte is capable of a ton of different other red wines, white wines, sparkling wines, dessert wines.
And also many other grape varietals you might not come across on an everyday basis.
Yeah, no question. Grignolino and other fun stuff like that.
Exactly.
So, Fresa. And you work for a winery now in all kinds of activities. You're involved in export, but you're also involved in winemaking for Enzo Brezza, right?
Yes. So, I work with Enzo.
So how did you get from training as a sommelier in the U.S. to working for Brezza?
It is basically my nonstop determination and never being afraid. I really... When I came to Piedmont full-time, I needed to figure out exactly what I wanted to do, and I really wanted to work in a winery. And when I came here and I was looking and thinking about the winery that I really wanted to work for, I made a list of all the producers that I loved the most, that I knew of in the United States and respected, and I had went and, you know, knocked on the doors of those producers to see, you know, if they would be able to take me as a right-hand man.
That is determination, because that is not a popular activity.
No.
I'm expecting that you got a couple of not terribly welcoming responses.
Yes and no. I mean, there were a couple of people that were a little bit taken aback by it, because you don't see too often, especially the culture here. It's not, you don't go somewhere and ask someone for a job. It's very like phone calls or emails, very discreet in that manner.
Well, an American young woman knocking on the door asking for a job, probably a little more unusual.
Exactly. But it worked out great. I honestly could not be happier. The family is wonderful. The wines that we produce are incredible, and just everything, you know, they have the restaurant and they make incredible food there, and the hotel, everything has just been, for me, a wonderful experience.
So this is one of these things that is sort of, it's funny, people go to California on vacation, they go to Napa or something, and they're seeing so-and-so family winery, and the winery has like a guest house or hotel or something like that. And that's happened in the last like 5-10 years or something along those lines. When you go to Piemonte and the village of Barolo, Brezza has exactly that, except that it's been there since what, 1881?
Yep.
So it's a funny thing that once in a while I have a client who comes back from the West Coast who says, "Wow, I went to this place and they had this hotel and they had this and they made wine in the place and I saw the vineyards and that's a new thing. It's amazing." And all I could think was like, yeah, this is innovation in 1880. And
1885, fantastic.
And
it's interesting, too, how it all started out at Brezza. It was the two brothers, Giacomo and Antonio, who started the whole thing. You know, it was a
so did one want to make wine and
bus
did one want to make wine and one wanted to have the hotel?
Basically, like, they started the restaurant and the hotel at the same time. I mean, the restaurant and the winery at the same time. Mm-hmm. In 1885, because there was a bus, it was a hybrid of like a bus train that came from Alba and dropped people off in Barolo right in front of where our winery is today. So when the people were waiting to take the bus, they could come into the bar, to the restaurant, have a glass of wine, have a coffee while they wait before they get onto the bus to go back to Alba.
So sort of like the travel stops along Exit 7 on the Jersey Turnpike for Piemonte from 140 years ago.
Exactly.
That's amazing. And how many generations of that family have operated the hotel and the winery?
Right now, they are on their fifth generation.
And what is the oldest wine that they have made that you have tasted so far?
Ooh, this was a couple weeks ago. We had a 1967.
Ooh, nice year.
It was alive still? It was incredible.
Was alive still?
It was super alive, super fresh. The tannins were still super aggressive, and it was really gamey, very earthy. It was, for Barolo, it was very incredible.
67's pretty hot year. 67's a little bit like 78, pretty hot year, and if people are making old-fashioned wines with lots of stems in there, that's not surprising. Yeah. That would have a big punch to it.
Yeah.
What was the occasion for opening it?
We had in town some very good friends, clients from Milan, who were really big wine collectors, definitely appreciated and knew their stuff, and we had decided to open up a bottle over lunch.
That sounds like fun lunch.
I know, right?
So I want to turn for a second to the holidays, because people are getting ready for holidays, and I wanted to try to have guests on who would give them perspective on how things are different in different places in the world and how people celebrate. So for you growing up versus for now, what have you gained, what have you lost over the years from being in two different cultures for the holidays? What is the biggest surprise and change?
The biggest surprise, and well, the thing is I grew up, I have a pretty large family, and we're all pretty close. And so spending the holidays always together was always a lot of things going on. It was always very exciting. And I still feel as though the same thing is happening here. Just not any of my family really lives here, so it makes it a little bit different.
Are different days celebrated differently? Is there a different style of entertaining, eating and drinking?
Yes. I mean, a lot more things, especially we could talk about this in two different ways, because there's the very traditional type of Christmas here, and then there's the more modern style Christmas, which is becoming more and more, believe it or not, Americanized. But the very traditional style Christmas is very religious and very, very much about the family. So, for example, on Christmas Eve at midnight, the whole family will go to their church together. They'll have their midnight mass. After the midnight mass takes place, you'll come home to one of the family's houses and have kind of like an aperitivo together. So you'll have, you know, salami, prosciutto, those kinds of things, as well as you might have some a cup of brodo, which would be, you know, a chicken broth, as well as some panettone or torrone.
And
it would be something very simple, very light. And then the next day, on the 25th, you'll have a large lunch with all the family again.
How long will that lunch take?
Oh, I want to say, I mean, if you're going to rush, it might be about 4 or 5 hours.
Begin around 1 o'clock, something like that?
Yeah. I mean, usually when you get the family together and it's a good crowd and you've got, you know, a lot of food and a lot of good wine, there's usually no hurry to get up from that seat.
No breaks in between?
Sometimes
No breaks in between?
Ah, there could be some dancing, some music playing.
So instead of being distracted by the football game, dancing and music?
Yeah, you see a lot of music and dance at a lot of the festivities here, which is kind of nice.
Is there a particular wine of the season? Is there a particular dish or food of the season that tells you that this is a holiday table?
Yes. The wine of the season around this time, because especially in this area, you see a lot of people drinking everyday wines as Dolcetto and Barbera. And for the special occasions, people will start to take out their nice Barolo, their nice Barbaresco. So for Christmas, you will see a lot more Barolo and Barbaresco. For the food, in terms of what they will have for the lunch, a lot of times it will be it's a type of chicken that's very, very plump, very juicy, but it's not a chicken, it's a rooster that has been fed a certain way to make it much more tender.
So a version of a capon, most likely.
Yep, capone, it's called here. And then also you'll see a lot of zabaione for dessert. Again, the panettone, which is kind of like, I almost want to say like fruitcake.
Yeah,
but
sort
they
of
can
a,
have it with.
It's like a giant yeast-raised sweet cake that's crumbly. And I'm always, whenever I have that, I'm always driven to kind of soak it in a little bit of grappa.
Ah, that's a good idea. I will have to try that this year.
It's. I don't know that it's always a good decision, but it does taste really, really good.
Yeah.
So what is the number one thing that you miss from the holiday in the U.S.?
Number one thing that I miss from the holidays, this is a good question. I definitely miss the hustle and bustle. Here it's much more quiet. You see a lot less lights, a lot less Christmas trees.
You could create those your own. You could create your own outpost and have like crazy Christmas lights shipped over next year.
I'm sure the town of Neve would love that.
I believe that would be an unpopular but fun decision.
Exactly.
Well. And my last question for you is, what's the first wine you're going to drink in 2014?
What's the first wine I'm going to be drinking in 2014?
Yeah.
Allora. So on January 1st, we'll probably be still champagne from the 31st of December.
Favorite champagne house?
Oh, this is a tough... I don't know if I can answer this question.
That's a terrible, terrible question, isn't it? I can never answer it straight. I always have like four answers for it, so. So give me something.
But to be honest with you, I'm really excited for the 2010 Baroli.
The vintage is fantastic.
I've had,
The vintage is fantastic.
Yeah. From the sneak peeks, I'm really excited, so.
Yeah, no, you're there at a very good time to be there with the release of the magnificent 2010s.
Yep.
Well, Amanda, thank you very much for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Enjoyed talking to you. Hopefully see you before too long in Piemonte.
Yes, definitely.
I won't bring you any embarrassing Christmas lights.
Fair enough.
Buon Natale.
Buon Natale. Grazie. Ciao.
Ciao. We'll be right back.